Welcome to the New Elizabethans, 60 programmes dedicated to the men and women who've changed this country or who reflect changes, good and bad, in British life during the Queen's reign. Tim Berners-Lee is a hero in a competitive, cutthroat world that moves at a dizzying speed, and he is different. He's been described as an archetypal English country vicar, trying to make people happy and to spread a little harmony in the community of battling software giants. He's always been like that. When he was a young physicist, he took a job at CERN in Switzerland, which is in the business of smashing atoms to smithereens. He took time off because he wanted to build something instead, and invented the World Wide Web.
It's a very simple idea, and the simplest ideas have the greatest effect. The universe of all information, all of mankind's knowledge, as one abstract information space. I thought of a lot of things to call it, but the thing I liked best was World Wide Web, the World Wide Web.
The size of the web is nearly impossible to measure. No one can agree on how big it is. But if you sat down at a computer at the end of 1993, there were probably 620 or so different websites. 5 years later, Google said that it had indexed 26 million pages. 10 years later, that figure was a trillion, a million million. It was Berners-Lee who made that possible. What's more, when he had worked out a way of spinning a web that would encircle the world, he had no interest at all in turning it into an idea that would be to his own financial benefit. You could say that he gave it away. He wanted everyone to have it. Every time you click on a universal resource locator, the web signature that we know as a URL that gives each page its own address, you're benefiting from the work of Berners-Lee, the man who took the fledgling internet and turned it into the most revolutionary form of communication produced since the invention of the printing press in the middle of the 15th century.
I didn't take possession of it and capitalize on it. If I had tried to do that, it would not have worked. If you love something, set it free. Because it was free, companies could invest in it, knowing that I wasn't going to turn around and say, well, it was free yesterday, but now I would like to charge you the following, now that you've signed along the dotted line.
He was born in London in 1955 to parents who were both mathematicians and who worked on the Ferranti Mark I, the world's first commercially available general-purpose electronic computer. He went to Emmanuel School in Wandsworth and then studied physics at Oxford. When he was an undergraduate there, he got a soldering iron and built a primitive computer of his own from an old television set using a simple processor. He was also caught hacking and banned from using the university computer. He went to work for the telecom company Plessy and then DG Nash in Dorset, where, among other things, he developed typesetting software for intelligent printers. On a 6-month attachment to CERN, he started putting together the elements of what would be his breakthrough discovery. He had the idea of writing a program that could store information with a revolutionary ingredient. It would handle random associations. And that was the embryo from which the World Wide Web grew. Remembering the Victorian almanac called Inquire Within Upon Everything, he called it simply Inquire. This was a musty old book of Victorian advice, he said, which I noticed as a child in my parents' house outside London. With its title suggestive of magic, the book served as a portal to a world of information, everything from how to remove clothing stains to tips on investing money. Not a perfect analogy for the web, but a primitive starting point. Inquire allowed many people to access the same data. The idea, he said at the time, was to let users store snippets of information and to link related pieces together in any way. To find information, one progressed via the links from one sheet to another, rather like in the old computer game, Adventure. He spent 3 years working at Image Computer Systems in this country and returned to CERN on a fellowship in 1984, when he was ready for the next step. Anyone who has lost track of time when using a computer knows the propensity to dream, he once said, the urge to make dreams come true, and the tendency to miss lunch. His idea was to develop a single information network that would help CERN physicists to share all the computer-stored information at the laboratory, connecting hypertext with the internet and personal computers. The World Wide Web is now a synonym for the internet, but in the early 80s the difference was easier to grasp. The principles of the internet were being laid down, a system of powerful computer networks that could exchange information. But it couldn't access the web, an information space in which every item had a unique identifier and acted as part of a connected system, linking people and things with common characteristics, a place where you could browse from your own computer and see it all. By 1989, Berners-Lee had drawn up a plan to put to his boss, Mike Sandel. It was called, prosaically, Information Management, a Proposal.
The only problem was that I wasn't supposed to be working on it. So when I said, hey, I think we should make a completely general global hypertext system, the very proper answer at CERN was, well, that's fine, but that's not what we're here for. So in fact, it was only because my boss, Mike Sandel, had a sort of twinkle in his eye and said, I won't complain if you just go and write the program. If Mike hadn't said that, if I'd have had to go through the process of trying to get a formal project approved, it would never have happened.
Sandel gave him 2 months to go away and work on it, and described the plan as vague but exciting. It certainly was. Berners-Lee decided to call the project the World Wide Web. In autumn 1990, he was joined by a colleague, Robert Caillou. By Christmas, they'd built the first web browser, web server, and web pages. But the World Wide Web was still a tiny network that didn't really stretch beyond the confines of the CERN lab itself. Thanks to a technical student called Nicola Pello, who wrote a simple browser program that could run on any computer, it became possible for anyone with an internet connection to access the web. And the great day, which surely must have its place in history, was the 6th of August, 1991. On that day, the first website, info.cern.ch, went online, and it is still there. The principle of what you see is what you get was established. What was on the screen was what could be printed out. The days of technological gobbledygook were beginning to pass away.
I know that you'd love me to say that, well, I got it all wired up, and then there was a big switch, and we threw the switch and the lights dimmed for a moment, but then there was this incredible high-pitched whine, and that was the web taking off all across the world, people starting to log on and type in hypertext, and we could feel the power of all these links spreading across the planet, and we just had to hold on tight, and then we turned it off. No, it was started off in a very small way.
In the year when the existence of the web was beginning to become recognised, 1992, Bill Clinton was elected President of the United States. He says this, "When I came into office, only high-energy physicists had heard of what's called the World Wide Web. Now, even my cat has his own page." And from the start, Berners-Lee was determined that everyone should have access to the power that he had harnessed with the invention of the web. He had no time for the idea of a closed space in which you needed special knowledge to be able to navigate. Mark Andreessen, one of the early web pioneers, who co-authored the Mosaic browser released in 1994, it was later called Netscape, says that there was reluctance. Back then, the key technical people didn't want the internet to become easy to use or graphical, because that would pollute the environment. Only smart people could use the internet. That was the theory. So we needed to keep it hard to use. We fundamentally disagreed with that. We thought it should be easy to use. Berners-Lee is notable for not having wanted to enrich himself from his work. In an age of web billionaires, he remains the pioneer whose principal satisfaction was the opportunity he created, rather than the property he amassed and could sell. In 1994, he helped to establish the World Wide Web Consortium, which was independent of government or any other organisation and was intended to promote research, to share knowledge, to mediate between web companies. It was a remarkable demonstration of his commitment to the idea rather than the product.
really, from the moment the code was on the web was a development, not of me, from then on it was the development of all these people working together at a time when it was not apparent to the media that the web was something wonderful. The fact that people from the grassroots can just have an idea, have a dream of how something can be, and quietly work together and make a revolution which shakes the world is just such a tremendously inspiring thing, the fact that it could actually happen.
Berners-Lee is one of the most remarkable innovators of the 20th century. His vision in taking the embryonic internet and creating a template in which its power could be truly exercised was the making of a revolution. Yet everyone who knows him says he remains a modest and undemonstrative man, although one with strong views. How many people would recognise him in the street? Very few, and that's how he likes it, which is another of his remarkable features. He was knighted in 2004, became one of the 24 members of the Order of Merit in 2007, and alongside many academic honours, he was named by Time magazine as one of the 100 greatest minds of the 20th century. He's still campaigning, leading the charge in trying to persuade individuals, governments, academic institutions, everyone, to make more raw data available on the web, because he thinks that will be good, encouraging people, as he says, to do wonderful things. When he was asked a few years ago why, when he designed the URL, he decided, to the irritation of future web users, to put two double slashes at the front of every web address, he admitted that he now thought they were unnecessary. "There you go," he said. It seemed a good idea at the time. I do hope you've enjoyed this programme. For more episodes and a full list of the new Elizabethans, go to the Radio 4 website.